Well, cool. Well, thanks for taking the time. I know it's, you're obviously busy, and I don't know if you saw my note in terms of kind of what I was hoping to get out of this. I'm definitely not a designer. Pretty much a novice, but very interested, and recently launched this sort of owners association site, just because there wasn't one already, and talking to the community, and it seemed like that might be something cool to do. I read your book, and I really enjoyed it. And I really was kind of loved some of the stories that you told in it, about working in the industry, and kind of the stories about the inspirations for the designs, and kind of realized that those boats, they were sort of a footnote in there, but there wasn't really much of a telling of kind of the inception of that. And I guess I kind of thought maybe that, if you could remember, or just even tell us a little bit about how that kind of came together, and just to give us a feeling for that, that would be a great way to start.
Talking about the history of things is always a good possibility that I'm going to get things wrong, right?
Yeah, that's.
But see, and I may not tell the same history twice, but and I get chronology wrong from time to time because I'm 73 now, and we're talking about stuff that happened in the 70s.
Right.
So, but. The essence will be honest and accurate with a certain tolerance for names and dates, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But Nor the Steve Nordvedt, who was the president of Nordic, his father was one of the guys that started Uniflight. And they built that up to a really big business. And then, of course, they got the Navy contract for the Vietnam gunboats, which was huge, and that's the origin of the fire retardant resin, right? Because the Navy specified fire retardant resin, and when I got to Unify, it was with the Valiant 40 project, and they would not use non-fire retardant resin because they didn't want to be running two different kinds of resin through their equipment, which made sense. And at that time, we saw the fire retardant resin as a huge benefit because we had foresight, we would have known that there were some problems attached to it later on, which sort of brought Uniflight to its knees. But the Valiant projects were rolling along, and they were selling Valiant 40s at a good clip, and then we did the Valiant 32 and the Valiant 47, and somewhere in that stream of boats, I think, like a lot of guys, when you're working for a big company, at lunchtime you sit around and say, "Well, if this is our company, we'd do it this way." And I think those chats amongst some of the guys at Uniflight gave birth to the idea of setting up Nordic. And they took some of the key guys from Uniflight and set up Nordic. So a lot of the build details you would see in a Valiant are also common to the Nordic boats because they're the
Right.
same people building the boats. The first boat Nordic did was the Esprit 37,
Right.
and I bought hull number one. That was a Nordic project, and I think, looking back, the Valiant liked the idea that they would be working with another builder because it gave them some leverage with Uniflight, which turned out to be interesting. But rather than being locked into Uniflight as Valiant's only builder, now they had Nordic building the Esprit, and Esprit sold pretty well. They did pretty well, and the irony was that when the Esprit contract ran out with Valiant, Valiant had Uniflight and Nordic both bid on the next group of Esprits, and Uniflight won that contract.
So, just to remind me again, the relationship between Nordic and Uniflight at the time, because weren't they all in the same family?
Yes and no. In that, Steve, I met Steve's dad, but only briefly. But there were some problems working with him, and he was sort of in and out of Uniflight. So by the time this all happened, Steve's dad, Art, I think his name was Art Nordvet, he was pretty much gone. And I think Steve just thought, hey, I can make more money and build a better boat if I start my own business. And he had a willing crew of workers ready to go with him if he started his own shop. And like I said, and that gave Valiant access to two builders, so they had some options. And that's how Nordic got started. And Unify was, it got kind of top-heavy, I think, maybe because of the Navy contract work. Because during the Valiant 32 project, I got a call one day saying they were having some difficulty lofting the stern. And I said, well, I'll be right up, because it was about an hour and a half drive from my office in Seattle. So I drove up and parked and walked into the loft floor and corrected the lofting and got that sorted out, and I went home. A couple of days later, I get this call that, oh boy, you caused trouble because you didn't go through the right channels. And I'm like, channels? what are these channels? but I didn't go to the sort of the supervisor of the Valiant 32 project. So that was sort of a eye-opener for me. I just thought you just go up and fix the problem, right? With Nordic, it was a lot closer relationship with Steve and the guys at Carl, who was sort of the foreman. It was just a lot closer relationship between me and them, but easier to work with. And I was toying with what boat to buy, and we were just about ready to have our first kid. And I almost bought an Islander Freeport 36, but the layout wasn't quite right for a baby, I didn't think. And so I bought the Esprit.
And this is around late 70s?
Yeah, it's 42 years ago, about the time my son was born.
Wow.
So we did the Esprit, and that came out just great. And then they wanted to do the Nordic 44. And right at that time, I was doing the Choi Lee 44, Lafitte 44, the Norseman 44.
A lot of 44s.
And now the Nordic 44. And boy, I really knew 44. I mean, I knew exactly what you could do with 40 feet of length overall.
Yeah.
And you ask here, what was the design inspiration for the Nordic? Well, for the 44, this was sort of the beginning of the end of the IOR, where IOR boats were starting to be less attractive to cruiser racers, or racer cruisers, right, as they got a little more extreme.
Right.
And so what I did was I looked at a Swan 44, and I thought, what would I do in 44 feet to take the best of the Swan and turn it into a real cruising boat? Because the problem with the Swans, if they had a problem, I saw it as a problem, is that they were racer cruiser boats that sort of, they were neither real racing boats and they were not real cruising boats. They were something in the middle, which didn't help the racers and didn't help the cruisers.
Interesting.
So I thought, what can I do that takes all the good things about that boat and turn it into a real cruising boat? And the first thing I did was design a hull that was not IOR-ish at all in any way. All the IOR measurement points which on the hull, which resulted in that sort of angular, you know, dead flat bottom, flat forefoot, and the sort of contorted buttocks at the stern. I eliminated all that stuff, and I just drew a smooth hull. And really, to this day, I still think it's one of the best hulls I ever drew. And they started selling Nordic 44s, and I thought that was a pretty impressive boat.
From there, so you went from the 44 to the 40?
Yeah, to the 40. And the only thing odd about the 40 was I was kind of famous for designing really difficult-to-build cockpits. Yeah, my attitude was you only build the tooling once, and then you build 100 boats,
right,
hopefully. So don't piss and moan about how difficult it is to build the cockpit, because you're only going to build that tooling once. But when we got into the 40, I looked at the cockpit of the 44 and I thought, well, that would actually, with minor modifications, that we can use that cockpit again. So that when you look at the 40, you see it has a proportionally wider stern, proportionally than the 44. That's because I had to make it wider to fit the cockpit in. And in retrospect, I think the 44 overall is the better performing boat, better feeling boat. But the 40 is a good boat too, and one of the things that probably does make it good is that the more beamier stern. And then we did the Nordic 34. No, we didn't do the Nordic. We did the Islander 34, which became the Nordic 34 when Islander went out of business. That boat was designed for Islander.
But based similar on similar proportions to the Nordics.
Yeah. In that it was there again. It was the tail end of the IOR, and I drew a boat that really wasn't an IOR boat at all. Just nothing about it was IOR, and which that boat turned into a tremendous boat, a really fabulous sailing boat. Not as big and roomy as a 34-foot Beneteau today, or. But a far better sailing boat. And then, you know, Nordic in time was picked up by, sold to a couple. I can't remember his name. I can't remember his wife's name either. His wife is really cute. And her father was the guy that started Nautor. So they took over Nordic, and that's when we built the two raised salon boats. The first raised salon Nordic 44 was designed trying to use as much of the original deck as we could, which makes it a real challenge because, you know, that I'm trying to use that deck for a different boat. And I'm pretty sure Steve Nordvedt still owned the company when we started that project. So the reason to try and use as much of the deck as possible was financial. Keep the cost of the new tooling down. So we built one boat, and it was okay. Mm. And then when this other couple bought Nordic, they were going to build a pilot house boat, but they said, hey, we'll start from scratch with the deck. And we actually raised the freeboard, I think, 6 inches, too. So it was a very different boat. And that boat was a super boat, really a super boat. And unfortunately, the guy that ended up owning that was a Seattle broker, and he just died here a bit ago. That was really nice, but I took that boat cruising, and it was a great boat. But they sort of never survived beyond that.
So, but then didn't Steve and his brother come back later on to sort of relaunch it in, I think, 2005 it was?
Yeah, probably about then. Do the 40 and build one for Carl, who was the foreman who had gone on to become king of the garlic farmers, I think.
Sorry, what?
as far as I know, he went into garlic farming.
Wow.
And did extremely well at it, extremely well. And, somebody's got to grow garlic.
Yeah. Right?
But he had them build a 40 for him, and that was a beautiful boat. But by then, the 40... I don't care how good the boat is. Once a series dies, once a model dies of natural causes, it's really hard to resurrect it 5-10 years later because the style of what's selling has moved on. And by the time we built that new Nordic 44, I mean, it was gorgeous. One of the reasons it was gorgeous is it had that nice overhanging bow. But they were trying to market that boat at a time when almost every boat by then had a plum stem, right? Which, in an effort to get as much volume as you can into a given length overall, a plum stem gives you a huge advantage. And however, the Nordic 40 with its rake bow was a much prettier boat.
What do you think, like in terms of just the appetite for the market? Where do you think it's evolved to in terms of? I mean, because obviously there's a huge secondary market for a lot of these boats. People are still buying. Where do you think the sort of modern appetite has gone in the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, it's pretty obvious where it's gone. All you have to do is look at any current European model, you know, huge fat transoms, twin wheels, because nobody wants to have to climb around the wheel to get to the swim step, which isn't bad. The huge fat transoms don't make for good sailing boats. I mean, the beauty of the 44 is, if you look at its very moderate shape, no surprises, as that boat heels over at different heel angles, it's essentially the same shape moving through the water. Not totally, but close to being the same shape. Whereas you take a boat that's got a plumb stem and a big wide transom, and literally some of the transoms are almost the same beam as beam max of the boat these days. You know, you'll see a 44-foot boat that's got about 2.5 inches of taper to the plan view of the deck, right? So it's almost, and some boats literally carry, some race boats now literally will carry beam max all the way back to the transom, but that's for getting the crew weight outboard for hiking. But on the production models, it's more about jamming and more accommodations aft and getting a huge cockpit with a, you know, fixed table in the middle. And so as the boats have been slowly morphing along, they've become less performance-oriented and more comfort-oriented and easier to sail, kind of. I mean, one of the things that's amazing today is you'll see boats, you know, up to mid 40 feet that have four winches. They have two primaries, and then they have two other winches flanking the companionway that handle all the halyards and all the spinnaker stuff. So that's not good. That's just cheap. I mean, it's not, you know, I go back to the days of like the Valiant 40 where we had a dedicated winch for each line, which is expensive, right? It's expensive and it's heavy,
right?
But God, it works great.
Yeah. So you think it's an effort to maximize, you know, reduce costs and maximize profit.
Yeah, I do. Well, you know, it helps clean up the deck. And most of these modern boats have those lines coming aft hidden. You know, they're under a cover, so they can't come back. And that cleans up the deck, and there's nothing wrong with that. We did that in 1973 on the Carter 39. We brought all the lines back from the mast under the deck. But we brought them all back to dedicated winches.
Right.
So that's... And then why is the fractional rig with swept spreaders so popular today?
Mm.
Well, one of the reasons for that is it's cheaper. You've got one chain plate.
Right.
Not counting your backstay, but for your shrouds. I mean, like a Nordic 44 has got a chain plate for the cap shrouds and 4.5 lower chain plates. So you've got 6 chain plates to install, as opposed to 2. So it saves money. Is it better? I think the fractional rig itself is better, per se. I'm not sure. And I think swept spreaders, they're simpler. And you don't have 2 lower shrouds, you only have 1 lower shroud, so you reduce windage. So yeah, it's better. It's better.
So just in that vein, is there anything that you might, thinking back on these designs, or that you would have done differently, or?
Well, I get asked that question quite a bit, and my answer is always, I would have done everything different. There's nothing I would have done the same. Nordic 44, I probably wouldn't have used that glue down non-skid, because I had that on the Esprit, and it became problematic. And it was great non-skid. It's just over time, it started to kind of lift up in the corners. And it was... the particular non-skid they used, as opposed to the original Treadmaster, was a different composition, and it wasn't quite as durable as Treadmaster. But it was in terms of non-skid, it was fabulous. I mean, one thing Uniflight did when they built their Esprits, they put actual Treadmaster down on the plug, and then they took the mold off of that, so they ended up with a Treadmaster-like non-skid. It was molded in rather than glued down. But I never, don't recall ever sailing the Uniflight boat, so I can't tell you how well it worked. But I think that, I mean, the interiors are a little old-fashioned compared to what you see today, but that doesn't mean that they aren't better, or at least as good. I mean, I'm always big for a nice big galley, And you see these European boats have pretty diminutive galleys and, you know, really small sinks which don't work and things like that. And I'm not wild about the Euro approach to an interior finish details, in that I like my boat to look like a boat, you know. And I like an all teak interior, and if people say it's dark, I said, yeah, so what? You know, I kind of like that myself. It's just over time, people have sort of gone to favor lighter interiors with more laminates, and which is cheaper. I like the way some of them are designed, and I think that I just don't like the priorities for the interiors. But in their defense, they're doing these one-size-fits-all boats, and they're selling a lot of them, so they're doing what their market demands.
So just a slight separate tact, but if you have a couple more minutes, I obviously I don't want to take too much of your time, but I wanted to ask you about kind of your experience coming into a very digital age. And I know that you've been very active in the community on Facebook and on Sailing Anarchy, and I've seen you participate. What do you think that's done to the, like, how do you think that's affected the industry, or what's your kind of view on sort of sailing into the digital age? Sorry, that's a lame term, but.
Well, there's two elements to that. I mean, at least there's the first element is you're forced to work to do the work on the computer, because builders don't want hand drawings anymore, because they're almost all using CNC cutting for stuff. And they certainly can't use it. In fact, the boatyard I work with the most here is building a Tom Wiley boat, and he still does all hand drawings. They have to take his drawings and sit down and convert them all to AutoCAD or Rhino 3D stuff, and which is a long process. And I remember I can almost remember the day when I got probably a fax from New Zealand saying, hey, no more hand drawings. They were building a 63 footer I designed, and hey, we want everything AutoCAD so we can change it to metric. And so all of a sudden I was forced to learn AutoCAD, which you do when you're forced, right?
Yeah, we all do. Just have to adapt.
Yeah, and so there was that element of it, and it brought some changes. I mean, guys that never drew by hand are at a disadvantage. Drawing by hand, you're sort of intimate with every inch of the hull. I mean, you know every inch of that hull, and you're making every decision, whereas if you're using a hull lines drawing program, you can give it a basic shape, and it will fill in all the holes and make the decisions for you. And I think a certain amount of sameness and boringness comes out of that. And you see that in, I mean, I look at it this way. I mean, I go out and to race, and I look around the fleet, and sometimes I can't tell what the boat is. And there was a day when I knew every boat, right? But right. Today they look so much the same, which is function also of sort of sports science. I mean, people complain that every professional golfer has the same swing these days, because we know scientifically what works and what doesn't work. So we know that a bit with a sailboat. So that's we don't get the diverse designs that you saw in the early 70s. There isn't that range of difference in the designs, which is too bad in some cases, and it's thank God in the other cases, because some of those boats are awful. So maybe today we get fewer awful boats and we get more, they're okay boats, right?
Right, just middle of the road.
Middle of the road, and middle of the road's good enough. So there was that technical end of going digital in the design world. And, of course, the design tools allow us to analyze a design, I mean, beyond your wildest dreams in 1975, right? In 1975, if you wanted to do a stability study, you had to do it by hand. Well, you didn't have to do it by hand then, but there weren't programs out that everybody could buy. There was a guy in Seattle that could do stability stuff, but he came out on, remember that computer paper that was about 15 inches wide and had holes down each side of it? Sort of, sort of green and green and white.
The dot matrix.
So he would do stability studies for me. But prior to that, to do a stability study, it took a guy who knew what he was doing a week, and it was a pain in the ass. So boats like the Valiant 40, I didn't do a stability study. I just knew it was going to be fine. I just looked around, and like so many other boats that are fine, it has to be fine. And it was fine. But today you can analyze a design in the early going stages of the preliminary design, and you can see the three decimal places, how it's going to sail, and what the stability curve is going to be like. Mm-hmm. So that's good, although it's resulted in people being sort of manic about this limit of positive stability. Now that we can get it so quickly on the computer, people sort of fixate on a limit of positive stability, but it's a pretty static look at an extremely dynamic situation. And I think people don't always understand that if somebody told you need 125 degrees of positive stability and your boat only has 122 degrees, it's not the end of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, in terminal conditions, you're not going to sit there and say, hey, no worries, we've got 3 degrees left. So then the other side of the digital thing, I can remember when I resisted email. Then I always had guys working for me who were ahead of me. When it came time for me to make the transition to email or AutoCAD, I had guys working for me who were already there, coach me. And of course, storing digital photographs. Oh, I want hard copies of my photos. Well, now you cringe, right? The thought of hard prints of all your photos. So all that stuff, the change to that stuff sort of became automatic as you realize the advantages. Huge advantage in being able to email drawings as opposed to, putting a big fat envelope in the mail to Taiwan. In terms of communication, I don't know when I got on. Well, I found Sailing Anarchy. You know Sailing Anarchy?
Yeah, I do.
I found Sailing Anarchy. God, I hate to say it, but it has to be close to 20 years ago. Wow. And it was kind of small and kind of fun and kind of rough and tumble, and I enjoyed it, and that's where the whole Flying Tiger project came from, was my involvement on Sailing Anarchy.
Could you just talk about that for a little bit?
Well, there was some discussion going on about a new, 32-foot sport boat, and I had drawn a boat, I can't remember why I drew, but I had drawn a 30-footer concept for Sailing Anarchy. So I said, well, I've got this 30-footer, and I put that up, and people said, well, that's close, but we want 32 feet. And I had a client at the time, Bill Stevens, and he said, let's build that boat that they want. Let's build it in China, and we'll sell them in China, because it's a growing market there. And so he came on the Sailing Anarchy and said, okay, tell us what you want. So we really had a design. You could say design by committee, but that sort of short changes it in terms of how well it worked, because it worked extremely well. It was extremely frustrating because, you'd get 10 different ways to do a tiller, or, when we put the windows in the side of the cabin trunk for the Flying Tiger, everybody had their own idea. That of all the things they argued about, was the shape of the windows. but we eventually came up with a boat, and we sold 120 of them. And I got a call from, I can't remember, it was like the University of Business College at the University of Chicago or something like that, and they wanted to know where this business model came from. And I don't know where it came from. We just made it up as we went along, It wasn't like we'd studied this dynamic of how to come up with a new design. We just sort of let it rip like a bunch of guys in the bar with beer after the race, right? Over time, about the time I moved my office up to the beach, where it is now, about 10 years ago, I found Facebook, and so I didn't do too much. Well, there were some things before Facebook. There was a few other sailing sites that kind of came and went. I can't remember any names, but most of them were just sort of platforms for arguing. But I got involved with a few of those and stayed involved with Sailing Anarchy. I still check Sailing Anarchy every day. And then I found Facebook, and my wife would laugh at it. What are you doing that for? Well, I'm finding my boats on here, you know? And my boats are popping up. And then one day I saw this thing. It was Robert H. Perry Yacht Designer Fan Club. And what the hell is that? I clicked on it and went to it, and there was a fan club. And it had about 320 members. So I joined, and now it's got 5,500 members. Exactly. And, you know, what it's done, the real beauty of it for me is it's put me in close contact with all these people that own my boats, people that I would never have met or had the chance to talk to, and never would have had the chance to talk to me. And, you know, I have to remind people that I didn't start the fan club. From time to time, because that'd be kind of ratty, but it's been huge. I mean, the one thing I didn't do as I started off in my business, I was never a photographer. So I had this incredible paucity of photographic records of all my designs. I had a lot of nice photographs that people gave me and builders gave me and that, but compared to what I have now, I had nothing. I mean, now I have hundreds of images of my boats all over the world, and that's been really nice. So I probably have more exposure on Facebook than any other designer, I think. I know Dick Carter found my Facebook, and you know the story of Dick Carter, because I work for him. And he said, "Boy, that fan club, that's really something." Blah, 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 blah. I said, "Well, Dick, you need a fan club." Oh, I don't do much computer stuff, and da, 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 da. So I got on my fan club, and I said, "Hey, my old boss Dick Carter, fabulous designer, needs a fan club page." And in 15 minutes, it was up and running. One of the guys from my fan club set up this page for him. Unfortunately, Dick doesn't ever get on it. He might look at it, but he doesn't respond to anything. So he's not a personal presence there.
How important do you think that is in terms of your kind of success is being a personal presence on Sailing Anarchy and Facebook?
Huge. I think it is. I mean, you could take the Chuck Payne approach where he thinks things like that diminish his reputation. He lurks on there, and once in a while he'll respond, but he rarely doesn't really promote much or contribute much. It's in terms of selling plans to people. It's been a game changer. It's been huge. And just getting my ideas out. And I've got one new project I'm working on now for a guy I met on Facebook. He's actually a guy from around here, right where I live.
That's
and
crazy.
I'm doing an 85-foot catch for him. So, I mean, I met him on Facebook in the fan club. So it's been, and you know, you are who they think you are, right? And so it lets a lot of people have a sense of knowing me, which whether they do or not, it's good that they think they do. And it's easy for me. I work by myself. I live on a beach in this remote area, so I have like zero social life. So I have the fan club. And I check in pretty much every day and try and contribute something and answer people's questions, and it seems to be fun.
And just one last question, and I'll let you go after this. What are your feelings about the sort of development of the sort of cruising YouTube? I know it's, I mean, and I just speak from as a younger person who sort of found sailing partly through YouTube. What are your thoughts on it? How do you feel about it as a kind of a platform?
I think it's good. There's support groups, right? And somebody wants to Somebody's going to buy in a certain kind of dinghy, and they can go on, hey, how's this dinghy working? In half an hour, they can get eight people telling them not to buy it. And or cruising information about certain ports and regulations and things like that. I think it's been huge in convincing some people to go cruising. It gives them a lot of contacts.
And have you noticed a shift in the sort of demographics of the cruising community in the last, 5 to 10 years, or has it been pretty consistent in terms of what you see?
No, I don't think I've noticed much of a shift. I mean, one thing that's happened is a lot of these boats, like Tiana 37s, that you can buy a used one now for $65,000. So you can buy a blue water capable boat, not inexpensively, but at a reasonable price today, which might allow some people to go cruising easier than it would have been 30 years ago. Because these old boats, they're not going away. I mean, they're solid laminate hulls. They're held for stout. You just have to maintain them and sometimes refurbish them. So it opens a lot of options. I mean, today I'm looking at a Nordic 40 that's for sale up in Victoria. I got two different consultation clients looking at it. And, well, I mean, for one thing, look at what Yacht World has done to the whole brokerage business. I mean, everybody goes to Yacht World, right? It's almost like a broker is a second thought, and how do I do this without a broker, which isn't always smart. But it certainly changed that business around, knowing that a guy sitting in Seattle can find a boat in France or in Greece or Germany. So that's huge.
Wow. Yeah, well, those are kind of, I guess, all the questions. I don't know if there's anything else that you sort of had or wanted to say before we split.
Not really. Thanks for buying my boats.
Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. No, and thank you again for your time. And I really appreciate, taking the time to talk to you. I think your participation, in the owner communities is super important. And I think it's a great, it's great that you're making that effort. So we
enjoy it.
But, you definitely, enjoy the rest of your day. And, if anything comes up or just let us know, and I'll probably do a little bit of editing, just to cut this down a little bit. And I'll send you a copy, and then we'll get it up to the site and
share. Okay, Tom, let me know if you need any drawings or anything.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. All right, we'll do.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.